Welcome to the RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. I am Matthias Kleins.
The first guest today is Professor Neil Stalker from the Department of Pathology and Infectious Diseases, who works down here at Camden Campus to investigate the biology of mycobacteria, some of the most important species of which cause tuberculosis in cattle and man. Thank you, Neil, for joining us here today. Neil, can you give us a quick reminder why mycobacteria are such successful pathogens and why they are so dangerous?
Okay, well, I'm not sure we know fully why they're so successful, and that's one of the things that people are doing a lot of research on at the moment. But in terms of infectious diseases, some of the most important ones in humans are firstly tuberculosis, and it's thought that a third of the world's population is infected with M. tuberculosis, the pathogen that causes TB, and about 2 million people die every year of tuberculosis. Other mycobacteria that cause disease in humans include Mycobacterium leprae that causes leprosy, which is still an important disease, and there's another mycobacterium called Mycobacterium ulcerans that causes a rather nasty disease called Bruelli ulcer. And so there are a variety of mycobacterial diseases that are important in humans. We also have mycobacteria that cause disease in animals. And in this country in particular, tuberculosis within cattle has been rising exponentially over the last 10 years or so. And that's a big problem economically. There is Mycobacterium paratuberculosis that causes a disease called Yoni's disease in cattle and other ruminants, and that is thought of as an economic disease. It causes wasting in cattle and it reduces milk yield. So there are a variety of diseases that are important both in humans and in animals. TB is particularly important because TB can pass from animals into humans, so it's a zoonosis.
So is there anything which all these mycobacteria have in common in terms of the way they, for example, evade the host's immune system, which makes them so successful? Because apparently they're terribly difficult to treat, and vaccination strategies so far are also not 100% successful. Is that right?
These bacteria all live within inside host cells. So for instance, M. tuberculosis lives inside the macrophage, and that's the cell in the body that is designed to kill bacteria. But they survive inside the macrophage quite happily and indeed thrive. And all the mycobacteria live inside cells. It's thought that they probably were originally soil bacteria and were used to living in very harsh conditions in the soil. And they seem to be rather good at surviving in adverse conditions.
When I looked at tuberculosis, the thing which struck me is that the pathogen has been known for more than a century now, and Robert Koch identified it from the tuberculosis lesions. And since then, research has been going on. But still, as you said before, tuberculosis causes a major threat both in humans and in animals. I do get the impression that progress is reasonably slow at the moment. For you, as someone who has been investigating the genome of tuberculosis bacteria using, for example, microarray technologies, do you think that the arrival of the genome is going to make a huge difference to that?
The genome sequence, which was completed in 1998, was a really important event in research. Working on mycobacteria is difficult because they're such slow organisms to culture. They're really difficult things to work with. And that means that doing research is extraordinarily slow and difficult. By having the genome sequence, we knew at that point every single possible protein that the bacteria could make. That saved us an enormous amount of time. And it meant also that people could come in from different fields and start working on tuberculosis, even though that wasn't their primary expertise. So the genome, I think, in this example, but in most other fields of biology, having the genome sequence has been an enormous advantage.
So the other people can come in because it's easier now to look for homologies between different pathogens and find common ground where you could help each other out with technologies. Is that how I can understand it?
I think it means that someone doesn't have to be an expert mycobacterial biologist in order to come in and start thinking about whether they have a contribution. So someone might have an expertise in a particular type of protein, but they've been working in another system. They can then find out just by doing simple searches whether Mycobacteria have similar proteins, and they can apply their expertise in Mycobacteria, and there are funding opportunities for them to do that.
Looking through your publications recently, I've found one paper which I thought was particularly interesting, and that's that you have identified a gene which is called HSPX, which seems to reduce the speed at which Mycobacteria replicate in the host. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of making that discovery?
I think it's important, first of all, to recognize that the biggest unsolved problem is the fact that most people who are infected with this bacterium, they do not develop active disease. What happens is the bacteria lay dormant inside their body. So the bacteria have these two modes of growth. They can grow actively, or they can lie dormant. In most people, 9 out of 10 people, that's how it stays. But in 1 out of 10 people who are infected, they develop active disease at a later point in their life. So they have latent bacteria which then reactivates and cause disease. What we've been doing is we've been looking at M. tuberculosis, which lacks particular genes, and we chose them in a variety of ways. There's a gene called DOSR, which is activated by the absence of oxygen, and it's thought that low oxygen has some relation to this latent phase that I was talking about. DOSR, in the presence of low oxygen, will then switch on a whole group of genes, of about 50 genes, and the one that is most dramatic is this gene called HSPX. What we found was that when we knocked HSPX out of the bacteria and that went into an in vivo model, what normally happens when you knock a gene out is that the bacteria either grow as normal or they grow less well because they've lost something. What we found is that the bacteria actually grew more rapidly, and this phenomenon, which we call hypervirulence, is rather unusual. So what this means is that the Mycobacteria grow faster inside a cell when they haven't got the gene. That means when the gene is present, they grow more slowly. And what we're suggesting is that there's a whole program of genes within the Mycobacteria which actually slow the growth of the bacteria down inside the host. And that makes sense if what you're producing is a latent infection. That what they don't want to do is grow rapidly. They actually want to grow rather slowly. They don't really want to activate your immune system. They want to be quiet, and eventually, maybe 10 years later, they might reactivate and cause disease.
To me, it didn't really appear sensible for a bacteria, which has to replicate in some ways, to have such a mechanism which would slow down the growth within a host. You've already touched upon this, but can you expand a little bit on the strategy behind it, which the bacteria is employing? And do you also think that probably using a molecule which would mimic the function of the gene product of this HSPX gene would be a future strategy for antimicrobial treatments in tuberculosis?
I think one of the really interesting things about Mycobacteria is that you can split them into fast-growing and slow-growing strains. And what you see is that the pathogens are almost always the slow-growing ones. So I would suggest that slow growth is a characteristic of Mycobacteria when they cause disease. What they seem to do is that they seem to enter the host, and essentially they just survive. The host then responds, tries to kill them, fails to kill them, and produces what's called a granuloma. And a granuloma is just a ball of inflammatory cells that surround the bacteria and stop it spreading. And while stopping it spreading is good for the host, it's also what seems to be good for the bacteria too. In fact, in spreading tuberculosis, what happens is that the granuloma, which the bacteria are sitting inside, sometimes become necrotic. That means that all the cells inside start to die. These will then break into an airway and allow the Mycobacteria to escape. So ironically, being within inside this ball of inflammatory cells is part of the process of dissemination of the tuberculosis. You asked about whether this can be used to develop some new control measures. And I suppose at the moment what's happening is that a lot of people are focusing on this side of the bacterial biology in order to say that if we can understand this in enough detail, we might be able to disrupt this part of the pathway. And you could say, for example, that if we knew what made the bacteria slow down their growth and become invisible to the hosts and sleep, as it were, if we could somehow disrupt that and wake them up, then they would be easier to kill. At the moment, when you treat a human for tuberculosis, you treat for 6 months at least. The first 2 months kills almost all the actively growing bacteria. The last 4 months are just to try to kill these ones, the last few apparently dormant bacteria. If we can reduce that time, that will hugely help controlling the disease.
So this would possibly be a measure to lure the bacteria out, and you could actually then expose them to the actual treatments which are available at the moment, is that right?
That's the sort of thing people are thinking about.
Well, that sounds as if you've made a very promising discovery there. If we go on to talk a little bit about the strategies to eradicate tuberculosis, one of the concerns seemed to be that the tests which are being used in the field at the moment to identify animals or humans which are infected are not totally specific to the subtypes of tuberculosis you mentioned before. And that seems to be presenting a huge problem. Now that we've got the genomes, do you think we can identify specific proteins to the specific subtypes which would allow us to improve the specificity of tuberculosis tests?
I think that's been one of the most exciting practical things that's happened with all the genome sequencing. What we have found is that the difference between M. tuberculosis and M. bovis is really the presence of deletions within the M. bovis genome. So M. bovis looks a little bit like M. tuberculosis with part of the DNA missing. Also, BCG, which is the vaccine that we use for TB, is like M. bovis with bits of M. bovis missing. So by knowing the genome sequence, we can identify which genes are in those regions that are missing, and those specific genes can be used as diagnostic tests. And there are a few proteins that are really promising and are making the tests much more specific. I think the question that we have to answer is how we can use tests routinely. Some tests we can do, they're more specific, but they need a laboratory and they're rather more expensive and they're harder to do in other ways. And so probably what we need to do is to carry on with the tests that we have, but use other tests in conjunction in a sensible and practical way.
Another big part of trying to eradicate tuberculosis is, of course, vaccination. And funny enough, like, people have been using pretty much the same vaccine over the last 100 years, is that right?
BCG was developed in the Pasteur Institute, and that's been used, as you say, for not 100 years maybe, but it's been used for a long time, and it's the most widely given live vaccine in the world. Ironically, although every survey that has been carried out, it works rather well in the UK, it doesn't work very well in other parts of the world. Sadly, that includes much of the developing countries. So trials that have been carried out in India and sub-Saharan Africa, BCG has not proved to be very effective against tuberculosis. So an improvement in a vaccine is something that's really important to look for. The ways people are doing that now is, rather than trying to get something that's better than BCG on its own, what they're trying to do is to boost BCG. So the idea is that you would be given BCG to start with, and then you would come along and have a second jab that would have a specific protein, perhaps from M. tuberculosis, and that would improve the immune response. Those are things that are ongoing, and they're happening in human trials at the moment. That might also feed into a vaccination that will be effective with cattle.
So what you're saying is that at the moment the use of BCG is being amplified by using a second antigen, or that is the strategy, and the molecular techniques now allow us, or will allow us, to identify specific antigens for specific subtypes and strains of the bacteria.
That's exactly what's happening. So prime boost is the phrase that is given to it. And yes, people have taken specific genes and they are either producing them synthetically or they're being put into expression vectors which allow them to be made inside the human. And hopefully these will improve BCG and make the vaccine more efficacious.
But do you think there's also probably potential that there might be a silver bullet somewhere on the horizon which will allow us to not even differentiate between strains, but really identify one completely new target in TBC vaccination and potentially take that into the field?
I don't think there's an issue about strains, because we can use a vaccine for human tuberculosis and for bovine tuberculosis. There are slightly different issues. In the bovine tuberculosis, we have to be able to differentiate animals that have been vaccinated from those that are infected, and therefore we have to have a diagnostic test because of the way we control it. Although that's a slightly different issue, the same vaccine may well be effective for both diseases. It's unlikely to be any different from this prime boost strategy, I think, because it's thought unlikely because of the cost and scale of trials that have to be done for tuberculosis. It's going to be impossible to do anything that doesn't include BCG as one of the components of a vaccine.
Because that at the moment seems the most cost-effective way of approaching vaccination, is that?
And it may not be ethical to not give someone BCG in a trial.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Neil, and giving us such an exciting insight into your work.
Thank you.